All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. That's right. We're back again. Just wait until you see what happens now. All right. We're going to have all kinds of stuff going on. And as I said, this is the Michael Slate Show, and we've got a great show for you today. But first, this.
Are you furious to see the sight of Imperial warplanes and missiles bombing schools, hospitals, and apartment buildings? Are you disgusted to see the sight of tanks rolling through villages and city streets? Are you heartsick at the sight of floods of refugees trying to escape the destruction and the carnage? Does it keep you up at night that a nuclear-armed state threatens the world with Armageddon? Do you want to see this Imperial military juggernaut stopped? Do you feel the responsibility to do more to support and stand with the people who are coming under attack this way? And did you think I was only talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine? Because when it comes to all of that, military interventions, mass murder of civilians, the creation of millions of refugees, shock and awe, death from above with missiles and planes, the USA stands as number one. 100 military interventions in Latin America, the war in Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, the current ongoing slaughter of people in Yemen, backed, supported, and armed by the US government. And it's the US that is the only country that has ever used nuclear weapons on people. So if you really want to do something to stop an oppressive military superpower that destroys whole countries, here's the good news. Instead of lining up behind the U.S. and thinking it can do something good anywhere when all the evidence points against it, you can be part of making a revolution right here in the belly of the beast. Get with the RevCons and Bob Avakian, who are organizing people for an actual revolution to really do something good for not only Ukraine, but for all the oppressed people of the world. Getting rid of this system of capitalism, imperialism, and ridding the world of the scourge of the kind of vicious conflicts it produces and requires.
All right, that was Noche Diaz, national spokesperson for the Revolution Club, recently on TikTok, and we'll be hearing more on Ukraine later in the show. At the back end of the show, I'll be talking with filmmaker David Zeiger and his other filmmaker, Mobolaji Oluwanu. And we'll be up. It's basically it's going to be on the upcoming film that they're both working on. Who the hell is Johnny Otis? Okay, I think that's the basic thing. So stick around for that. And before that, we'll hear two short statements from the RNL or Revolution Nothing Less show with Andy Z and Raymond Latta on war in Ukraine. And right now, folks, we're going to hear conversations with Adrian Lawrence, Sansara Taylor, and Lori Sokol on the conversation from the Young Turks YouTube channel. Check this out.
It's still Adrian, but this time I have some women who are exceptional when it comes to talking about things that largely advance women in our communities, particularly abortion rights. That's Sansara Taylor, co-host of the RNL, that's Revolution, Nothing Less, and Lori Sokol, that's executive director of Women's E! News. Thank you so much for joining us, Sansara and Lori.
It's a real pleasure to be with you, Adrian.
Yes, very much so. I agree with that.
Yes, and it's a pleasure to have you all here. The thing is, it's like we have a nice percentage of our population facing a number of issues when it comes to restrictions on our bodies. Essentially, what's the update here? If you want to go ahead and share first, Sansara, please do.
Yeah, we're in the middle of an abortion rights emergency, which Texas, people should know, has been under a near total abortion ban for over 6 months. And the Supreme Court is currently considering a case that could overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 decision that legalized abortion for women. And anticipating that this will happen, states across the country packed with fascist legislatures are like in a race to figure out who can do the most vicious, cruel abortion bans. Idaho just introduced a law that would incentivize rapists and their families to sue to prevent a woman from terminating her pregnancy. Missouri passed a law that would ban or introduce a law that would ban abortions even in the cases of ectopic pregnancies, which are never viable. It's when the egg implants outside the uterus and often lethal to a woman. And they added a ban that would restrict a woman from traveling to another state. So they're literally saying that a woman should die. And what we're facing is within a matter of a few short months, half the country could lose access to abortion. and the whole assault on women everywhere would accelerate. And I just want to say that forcing women to have children against their will is a form of enslavement. This is what we're facing, and this is why Lori and I initiated RiseUpForAbortionRights.org to bring people into the streets to say this must not happen. We cannot allow this to go down.
No, we can't, not at all. And so I'm so grateful that both of you have come together to raise awareness, to make change. Lori, I'd love to hear your thoughts on essentially this whole new, it almost seems like a new era in terms of the attack on women and our bodies.
Well, it may seem like a new era, but unfortunately, the underpinnings of it have been building and increasing for many years. And I think they particularly culminated when Donald Trump became president, because he allowed this really insane brutality against women's reproductive rights to build beyond, you know, since Roe v. Wade had become law in the early 70s. We have never seen this assault on women's reproductive rights before then. But let me also say that this isn't about, you know, those who are anti-choice. It's not about saving the lives of babies. Not at all. I mean, let's be true, honest here. If you were to look at the rates, if you look at countries where abortion is legal and where abortion is illegal, there's no significant difference between the number of abortions women have in these countries. It's just that 30,000 women on average die in countries where it's illegal. Okay, that's from botched abortions, which is going to be happening here in the US as well. So you were talking about tens of thousands of women potentially dying from this. What they really are looking to do long term, and this is very important, because when people listen, they think about abortion rights, they think only about how this impacts women. And since women are still, you know, second-class citizens in this patriarchal society, those who are not women are those who don't have daughters or sisters, or they feel they're not going to be impacted by this, but they are, because what Roe v. Wade also solidified was the right to privacy, which affects every single American. So it may be abortion now, but then it's going to be right to contraception. It's going to be how to raise one's children. It's going to be how to maintain family relationships. Who can live in your house with you? Brother, sister, aunts, uncles, parents, etc. It's also going to impact marriage equality, interracial marriage. And already we see in Texas the Don't Say Gay bill, right? Not allowed to discuss, to teach anything about homosexuality or transgenderism. What if you have kids who have two mothers or two fathers? How are they supposed to think of themselves, right? If it's against the law to even mention it or talk about it. So this is just the beginning of what fascists are looking to do in this country, the Republicans who are against reproductive choice. It's going to affect every single American in one way or another. So if we don't stop it now, this is really our last chance.
Yes. And as you were talking about that, Lori, it was really resounding with me. All I was hearing in my head were the Supreme Court decisions, Griswold in Texas, Loving v. Virginia, so on and so forth. And the fact that some of these things were passed some 50 years ago at the most, yet at the same time, they can be reversed in a moment's notice, especially given the very conservative court we have. And you're absolutely right. The thought that we could lose right to contraceptive, we could lose a right to privacy, Lawrence v. Texas, all of these things that have allowed us to live our lives and to allow people of, regardless of what political party they are a part of, just to operate, that could be rolled back. And so we are truly heading toward that handmaid's tale. And so, Sansara, I would love to know, what do you think we need to do to stop this train now before it steamrolls every right that we have as individuals?
Well, I want to start by appreciating how you asked the question, because it's the right question. It's how do we stop this train now before it steamrolls further, which is the opposite of what the so-called leaders, or most of the so-called leaders of the so-called women's movement, are doing. And I have to call this out to begin with, because the heads of the mainstream organizations are telling us the best we can do is prepare for post-Roe, prepare for Roe v. Wade to fall, help women learn how to induce their own abortions, help women to travel to states outside of their own as it gets banned where they are. and to try to pass some local legislation in a few places to protect abortion after the legal right and protection falls nationwide. And what we have said, this is capitulating in advance. It will foreclose the lives of women, and it will give it'll give these fascists a chance to put their foot on the accelerator even more and gain even more ground. So we have to draw a line now. And what needs to happen, and the reason I'm wearing this green bandana, is because we need to learn a lesson from the women of Argentina, the women in Colombia, the women in Mexico, women who went into the street and waged massive, sustained protests again and again, where they changed the whole political atmosphere, and they tore down anti-abortion restrictions in those countries. They made what seemed impossible possible through their struggle. And so what we are calling for in riseupforabortionrights.org, and it's the number four, is we're calling on people to join us in the streets in protests that grow, and that not just a one-day protest, but again and again, students walking out of school, professionals coming out in their white coats or their professional associations, people from different walks of life, people speaking in the arts and the sciences and wearing this green. On April 8th is a national day of wearing green across the country. It's a Friday. And then April 9th, we're calling people back into the streets. We just did protests on International Women's Day in a dozen cities. We want these to be even bigger, with thousands and thousands of people, to wake up and impact millions more. They don't even know this emergency is happening, because the Democratic Party has been silent about it, because the so-called leaders of the so-called women's movement are not sounding the alarm and calling people into the streets. So by being into the streets ourselves, we want to wake up many more people to then join us and create such an outpouring from below, such a massive refusal to let this go down, that we change the atmosphere throughout society so that the Supreme Court has to recalculate based on the demand from below. The state legislatures have to recalculate based on what we are just saying in the streets with our bodies.
That seems like a very, very powerful movement. The fact of this thought that we need to make noise and disrupt to make the movement. And I am definitely a fan of that. And it's so incredibly important. And the thing is, we've seen it operate and do pretty well, right, Lori? We had women in Argentina and Colombia recently winning historic victories when it came to abortion rights, and they took to the streets. What was the secret, or what did they have that we may need?
Well, I don't think it's a secret. People in the US may think it's a secret. For some reason, we don't feel that it's as urgent to step out in the streets. And I have to tell you personally, as someone who's been writing about women's equality and rights for, you know, a couple of decades, I also did not go out into the street until this last month and a half. And I've marched and I've spoken at three rallies thus far, because I thought to myself, what kind of a feminist would I be if I did not step up now and really be truthful and honest and join, you know, my sisters and some brothers in walking and marching, because this is really gravely serious. And if anyone wants to call themselves supportive of women, of their rights, feminists, you have to be out there in the streets. Yeah, you know, COVID is around the world, right? COVID was in Argentina. COVID was in Colombia. COVID is in Mexico. But it didn't stop them. We don't want to say it's too late, and then we have to go backwards again, you know, go backwards, and women are going to die. So women are going to die. So for every person who does not step out and step up and walk and march in the streets with us, blood is on their hands for every woman who will die from botched abortions in this country.
And it's incredibly sad, and I wish I felt more moved in the thought that Americans would care, but we see femicide every single day. And so I really do hope that there is something that wakes people up and makes them realize that the rights that they have can be taken away. But, you know, right now, with a lot of people focusing on the war going on over in Europe and Asia, it's one of those things where I'm very, very afraid that people don't necessarily get it. But Sansara, I'd love to ask you in these last few seconds that we have available, for those people who do get it and those who want to learn more so that they do get it, where can they go to learn more about the organization you all founded?
It's called riseupforabortionrights.org. It's the number four. It's riseup4abortionrights.org. And I just have to say, that what we need is courage. What we need is hope. What we need is those who do understand the emergency to stand up, because that itself is contagious. We are the majority. People support this right. It doesn't count unless you show it and get in the streets. But if you do, don't underestimate what we can accomplish. There are millions of lives at stake. All of them are going to be touched. We need to mobilize them now. And I think there's every basis to do that, but it takes stepping in right now. So I want to call on everybody to do that. Rise up, number4abortionrights.org. And thank you so much, Adrian, for having us on.
Thank you so much for joining us. And yes, those out there, viewers who do get it, please wake others up, because they're not woken up yet. And we need them to understand that everything is on the line right now. We could stop it now, but only if they get out there in the streets. Thank you so much for joining me, Sansara Taylor, co-host of the RNL, Revolution Nothing Less, and Lori Sokol, executive director of Women's E! News. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Uplifting the message. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that was Sansara Taylor and Lori Sokol from Rise Up for Abortion Rights, speaking with Adrian Lawrence from The Conversation. You can watch the video on the Young Turks YouTube channel. Now, the war in Ukraine should be outrageous to anybody with a sense of justice, but especially for people in the U.S., it should not mean supporting U.S. imperialism. Too many progressives are doing just that, not only supporting U.S. imperialism, but demanding more aggression from these imperialists. So let's hear from Andy Z from the RNL or Revolution Nothing Less show, talking about American warmongers.
We are being barraged by media fools, so enthralled to this system, so sated and satisfied by their scarfing up the spoils of this system that it wrings out of the exploited and oppressed people here and around the world that they have lost their goddamn minds and are falling all over each other to insanely beat the drum that the U.S. should wage direct war on Putin's Russia in Ukraine. This is not just the fascist Fox News, who have developed a bad case of amnesia about how they and their fascist Trump just a week or two ago were lauding Putin, but they are now playing the tough USA, USA guy. But then here's the oh-so-liberal Joy Reid from MSNBC News.
My father he's passed away now, but he was from the Congo. The United States, when they decided that Patrice Lumumba wasn't good enough to be the George Washington of the Congo, made sure he was quite gone. You look at Iran. When we decided we didn't like Mossadegh, that was the end of him. The United States decided we didn't want Saddam Hussein. That was the end of him. I think for Americans to look helplessly while we watch these people slaughtered, it feels like we shouldn't be helpless. You, as somebody who was the head of an agency that has incredible power, incredible reach into the entire world, isn't there something we can do? Because when we wanted to do it, and when there were people we thought were not fit to run a country, we did it.
Here's NBC's Chuck Todd pushing Biden's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, on why not a no-fly zone.
I want to talk about the no-fly zone. Let me quote President Zelensky on Telegram on Friday. He essentially sent this out on social media. All the people who will die starting this day will also die because of you. He's addressing the West. Because of your weakness, because of your disunity. Today, the alliance's leadership gave the green light for further bombing of Ukrainian cities by refusing to make a no-fly zone. I understand it's an emotional statement, right? And I understand you've had different conversations there. Why rule out the no-fly zone? Why not make Putin think it's possible?
And just in case you think we at the RNL show have a thing against NBC, here's the whole White House press corps pressing the White House to directly, militarily confront Putin.
President Zelensky has been speaking to Congress tomorrow. He's been pushing for fighter jets, a no-fly zone. You have to hear some of those same requests tomorrow as well. Has the administration thinking shifted on that at all?
Millions, though, calling for a no-fly zone. They're a NATO member. They share a border with Russia. How do we view their calls for a no-fly zone?
Would a strike in Poland on supplies or anything, really, automatically be met with a military, a forceful response?
Is the president showing enough strength against
Putin? Why does the U.S. believe they know better what Ukraine needs? Put it bluntly, is Zelensky wasting his time tomorrow? asking for these things.
If Putin were to use chemical weapons, would it change the president's thinking when it comes to these MiGs?
These hyenas of the press corps are dangerously, unrelentingly brainwashing you, the people of this country, and building pressure on the government for a war between the ruthless imperialists on both sides, Russia and the U.S. NATO bloc, that no one with a shred of humanity should support. On our website, revcom.us, this week, it sharply puts the stakes of this. Quote, even as the Russian invasion of Ukraine is utterly unjustified and reactionary and should be politically opposed, the Ukrainian President Zelensky's drumbeat of calls for the U.S. NATO to attempt to institute a no-fly zone over Ukraine is extremely reckless and, frankly, unconscionable. If this were done, the U.S. would be obligated to shoot down any Russian plane entering this zone, and such a shootdown would constitute an act of war, one with unpredictable consequences. Think about it for just 1 minute. Such direct warfare between U.S., NATO, and Russia could rapidly develop into World War III, leading to destruction and death on a scale far, far beyond what is happening now, including very possibly the use of nuclear weapons, which in turn could lead to the extinction of humanity as a whole. How would the Ukrainian people or anyone else possibly benefit from that? With this in mind, extremely reckless and unconscionable is the least that can be said about this, end quote. These are dangerous times, perhaps the most dangerous. Just in the last week to 10 days, this is a stark reality of the future that confronts us. First, the bloody war in Ukraine threatens wider war, even nuclear war. Even in a nuclear war where only one nuclear weapon is dropped, 34 million people would die instantly, facing that instant death with the after effects potentially destroying all life on Earth. And it's likely this would be even a greater catastrophe. The acceleration of climate catastrophe, with over 3 billion directly in the crosshairs, facing deadly drought, catastrophic storms, floods, food shortages, with again the potential for human extinction. The imminence of women in this country losing the legal right to determine their own lives through the likely ripping away of their right to abortion by the Supreme Court sometime this spring. This is nothing less than a way of enslaving women to the dictates of an oppressive, male supremacist, patriarchal system, turning her into a criminal with penalties for choosing when or when not to have a child. Each of these horrific futures, which really are a future that is no future at all, are the result of the workings of the system we live under. A system that prevails everywhere in the world today, capitalism, imperialism, a system whose time must be up, a system that must be overthrown, or our time, humanity's time, could be up. I say this not for drama, but because it is objectively possible. These are the stakes.
All right, that was Andy Z on the Revolution Nothing Less show. And new episodes of the show come every Thursday on the YouTube channel, The RevComs. We've got one last piece from Raymond Latta. Russia has oligarchs, but America has. Let's give it a listen.
Have you noticed how Russia has oligarchs, but America has entrepreneurs? Have you noticed how Russia has bosses, but America has CEOs? Have you noticed how Russia's rich hide away their yachts and villas? But in America, you have lifestyles of the rich and famous. Have you noticed how Russia is an evil petro state? But America's position as the number one producer of oil and natural gas in the world is energy independence. And did you notice this? In January 2022, Apple became the world's first $3 trillion company. But there would be no Apple without its supply chains of horrific sweatshops in China and other countries. There would be no Apple without the 40,000 child miners in the Congo digging tunnels and hauling rocks to extract cobalt that helps power cell phones, computers, and much more. You see, in America, we have high-tech companies and venture capitalists, but heaven forbid, no oligarchs here.
Keep alive. All right, that was Raymond Latta, and we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with the rest of the show, so stay tuned. You don't want to miss any of this.
He got a cool little chick named Rockin' Billy. He can walk and stroll in Susie Q and do that crazy hand jive too. Papa told Willie, you'll ruin my home. You and that hand jive has got to go. Willie said, Papa, don't put me down. They're doing Sister Flo. Grandma gave baby sister a dime. Said, do that hand jive one more time. Doctor and a lawyer and an Indian chief. Now they all dig that crazy beat. Way out Willie gave them all a treat. When he did that hand jive with his feet.
All right, once again, that was a musical break after talking with Raymond Latta. That was the musical break between his show, what was going on, and what we're going to have right now, all right? Now I want to introduce my guest. That's right, I'm learning how to talk again, okay? Now I want to introduce my guest, and he's sitting over here. There's a couple of them, but I see this one sitting over here, and he seems to be eating or scouching around for something. I don't know what the hell he's doing. His name is Dave Zeiger. He's a filmmaker of many documentaries, and he's also someone who's brought in another person who I have really followed his work and really enjoyed seeing him, talking with him. And his name is Mobolaji, and I got to get this right, Mobolaji Olambi Wanunu. Is that right, Mobolaji? Sorry, I'm losing my mind here.
Mobolaji,
Mobolaji, you here?
Yeah, I'm here. Mobolaji Olambi Wanunu.
Okay, we need to get somebody in here to get some because we can't hear you.
I can hear him. Oh. I can hear Mobolaji.
Oh, okay. All right. Well. All right. Anyway, Dave says he can hear you, so we're gonna just basically jump in with this. All right. I wanted to make sure that people know who we're talking with, so I want to introduce you. It's Dave Zeiger, who's a filmmaker of many documentaries, and Mobolaji. Who is the director of the powerful 2021 film Ferguson Rises, which tells the story of the aftermath of the police killing of Michael Brown.
We're here, Mobolaji and I are here to talk about our new film that we're making together, which is Who the Hell is Johnny Otis? And the reason the title is Who the Hell is Johnny Otis is because the film is about Johnny Otis, who was one of the great innovators of rhythm and blues music, in particularly in California, but in the country as a whole, and not just in rhythm and blues, but also early rock and roll. But he has pretty much faded into obscurity. Most people don't know who he is and what role he played, which was a very powerful role, not only in terms of music, but in terms of the fight against white supremacy, particularly during the 1960s in this country. And that's what the film is revealing about Johnny. And we've got We have a sample, you know, piece that we've produced that I think if we that speaks a whole lot better than I do about
on today's about show, Johnny. It's speaking a whole lot better than all of us.
Right. Mobilaji, you want to cut in here? What I'd like to do is I want to play clips from the show.
Let me get just a little bit of Mobilaji. I haven't seen you or talked to you in a long time. How are you, man?
I'm good. Great to hear your voice. Glad to be on the show. Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate your having us. David, I think said this. You know, jumped us off correctly. I think in that Johnny Otis is someone that I didn't know about until David introduced me to Johnny Otis. And so I think this is really important, a really important part of our history that we've forgotten, or a lot of us have forgotten, and particularly for those of us who were not alive in that era, you know, we didn't know about and, you know, has really been hidden from us because I think it really speaks to the work that that Johnny Otis, who is a white ally who worked in solidarity with black folks in the freedom fight, in that era, in the 50s, 60s, and beyond. And I think it's something that we really never really, you know, we never hear about. We don't hear about some of those early folks who really took a fall and took the hit to really be, to stand on the right side of history. And Johnny Otis did that. And I think it's important, in particular now, as it relates to my work with Ferguson, you know, there are plenty of folks who stood on the front lines of Ferguson who were not African-American, who took the hit as well. And I think so Johnny Otis speaks to not only the past, but also to the present and to the future in terms of the work that we need to do as a people in general, as people of all ethnicities, to work towards liberation, freedom, you know, civil rights and human rights. So that's my feeling about Johnny Otis. And the need for this project is really important at this particular juncture in history because we're seeing a resurgence of a lot of the white supremacist ideology in a way that we've never seen before. It was always there, but we're seeing it really come to the surface in really egregious ways that really attack the freedoms that many of us have fought for. We're not certainly as free as we would like to be in this country, but I think these folks are even rolling it back even more, you know, and so this is a great opportunity to really speak to that. And we want to really just encourage folks to find out more about Johnny Otis and support us. And if they want to find out more about Johnny Otis, to email us at johnnyotisfilm@gmail.com. Cause we're looking for, you know, we're really looking to support this movement. We're looking to support this film and really raise the funds and make the partnerships with individuals who find this information valuable to move forward and create a successful film.
Mm-hmm. Dave, you have something you want to say about that?
Yeah. I think that Mobilaji really put it all together. There's a particular thing that I think is important about, like, this is a film about the past on a certain level. Because it's about Johnny, who was a band leader and songwriter and producer in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and particularly had his strongest impact in the 50s and 60s. But the thing is that in today's world, where the whole the issue of white supremacy and the issue of how is it going to be attacked and how is it going to be eliminated, and who has to be part of that, is such a crucial, you know, issue right now, that stories like Johnny's from the past can have a big impact on how these things are approached today. This was true with my film, Sir No Sir, about the GI movement during the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, that had a big impact during the Iraq War when the film was produced. And we, you know, we're hoping that can be the kind of impact that this story has, along with the fact that there's just a lot of great music too. I mean, Johnny was responsible for and produced some of the best music of the early rhythm and blues and rock and roll era. Ironically, in the 1960s, when rock and roll took off in a big way, he was somewhat left behind, and as a lot of what he had done in the 1950s was redone by white musicians like the Rolling Stones, et cetera, and became very popular in that way. And but it's still the roots of this and the basis for it are extremely important. And also Johnny, you know, was, you know, again, as Mobilize just said, as a white person, he, and this is probably going to be controversial in this film, but we really want to take this on because Johnny was someone who grew up in the black community and was essentially his entire world was the world of the black community. And he not only was part of it, but he promoted it and he referred to it in ways that not too many people do, black or white. So can we, I'd actually like to play that second clip, not the first one, but the second clip where that's talking about the Watts community. Johnny lived in the Watts community and had his first club there. And he wrote a book called Listen to the Lambs right after the 1965 rebellion and the Watts riots. And it's a pretty startling book, and it had a big impact when it came out. And so this first clip is from what he wrote in that book, and it's being read by Kurt Baltz, the actor Kurt Baltz. It's not Johnny actually talking in this, but you got that one, the one that starts at 4:25?
Johnny's history in black Los Angeles started on Central Avenue, but in many ways, the farther south you went, the more meaningful it was to him.
I thought it would be nice if I could open a club in Los Angeles that would feature that kind of revolutionary new sound that we felt coming and we were part of helping develop.
The Barrel House Club that he set up on 107th. He lived in Watts. Many of his best friends were from Watts. And he felt in some ways that this was the part of black LA that was most like the South, that was most like Africa, that was most loving and culturally distinct.
Watts is shot through with visual evidence of its plight, and even when its blemishes and the squalor cannot be readily picked up by the eye, they can be felt. You can almost cut with a knife the rage that this imposed ugliness generates. In the more densely populated and consequentially shabbier neighborhoods, this grim and unlovely emotion pervades the atmosphere like a noxious gas. But on the other hand, in Watts, as in any other spot on Earth where the human spirit refuses to yield, there is deep and startling beauty. In the heart of Watts, one can feel the surging glory of the African spirit. The Afro-American character, uniquely fashioned under duress, battered and bruised, often diluted and diverted by some sociological miracle, survives. It survives in spite of centuries of genocidal onslaughts and white supremacist propaganda. It is surviving and is, in fact, triumphing in the splendor of gospel music, in the creative soulfulness of rhythm and blues and jazz, in the brilliant, bright eyes of a black child who dares to hope even though he is surrounded by an immediate sea of hopelessness. In the ebony chiseled dignity of an old man who sits amid the rubble of a burnout building on 103rd Street, cleaning 100 bricks a day for a penny apiece.
And it's important because Johnny saw over a 10-year period things getting worse and worse in Watts. And many of the things that he did politically, many of the things he wrote in his newspaper, were predicting that there would be some kind of upheaval.
Yeah.
Go ahead. That was okay. Pretty damn good.
That last part, as I said, that was Kirk Baltz, and he was reading from Johnny's book, Listen to the Lambs. Johnny was a high school dropout. He actually, his story starts when a counselor at Berkeley High, where he was, called him into his office and said, basically, he said, look, you're white. You shouldn't be hanging out with all these black kids. And Johnny turned around, walked out of that office and left the school and never turned back and devoted his entire life to the music and the culture and the life of the black community. And I think that was beautifully expressed in his description of Watts in that book.
You know, the other thing just related to that, too, though, is that there is this point about, you know, there was a way when he did things like that and he challenged things like that. And wasn't going to sit back and say, okay, well, maybe I'll just wait and see if I can work it out, or, you know, I can get it here, go there and here, go between the little crevices that are in there and stuff, and I'll make my way through. But there's really something else that came out of this. When you think about who this person was, who he was, and what difference does it make that somebody like him and his friends, his black friends, that the school warned him to steer clear of, you know, bringing the whole situation to the world, bringing what they were doing, what they felt like, what they saw, what they thought, what they wanted in the world, you know, to bring that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's hard to find that even today. It's hard to find that kind of challenge that people are facing with. And they're finding ways to actually step up against this. And I thought that was one of the very moving thing about this, where he had the whole question of, what did him and his cohorts, his black friends and the school, when they warned them to steer clear of each other, what did they bring to the world instead? You know, very important, yeah. I think, and especially in that time. You think about that time, what the hell was going on? I mean, think about what was going on here about, you know, if you were black, you did not want to be out in the street and maybe not even in your own house because they were going to come and get you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, and I think that point about what did they bring into the world is really good. Oh, Mobilaji, you got some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's just an extremely moving and inspiring story about someone who had the courage to really stand up for their convictions and express themselves creatively on so many levels. You know, besides Johnny being a musician, he was a painter, a sculptor, a cartoonist, a writer. So many different things. I mean, just an inspiration to anybody who's interested in expressing themselves and figuring out exactly how to do so in a world that may not accept all the ways in which you want to express yourself. So I think we have a longer teaser available for folks who want to watch. If you email us at Johnny Otis. film@gmail.com will send you the longer teaser and more information about the film. But yeah, I mean, I think Johnny really, just in learning and in working with David on this, I'm just, as an artist, just thoroughly inspired by his conviction and his commitment to really seeing his conviction through no matter what. And his courage and commitment to live in the black community at a time when integration was not really prevalent, right? We didn't have a whole lot of white community members in Watts, I'm sure, at that time. I would guarantee, I don't know the exact number, but for him to choose to make that decision, for him to choose to be there and to not only be there in a sort of itinerant kind of way, but to be there as an active and committed resident of the Watts community is really inspiring to watch. And then what he did while he was there, the stuff that he created, the individuals that he discovered and helped, whose careers that he helped to facilitate. I think all of that is just speaks to the magic of who this person is. And to the magic of really working in solidarity with the black community. I think he also, in that little clip, he also highlights sort of the beauty of the black community that I think is often forgotten, even by many of us who are members of the community. Being both an outsider and kind of an insider, Johnny sort of brought this this unique perspective, and you could hear that again in his in the writing, where he really saw the beauty of the Black community, and again in a way that I think many of us forget that are inside the community, you know, and I think that's also inspiring to see and hear. And to understand the beauty of our community, you know, in a way that that perhaps we may not always always see in the midst of all the chaos and all the violence and all the you know, the white supremacy, really.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I was thinking, even as you were talking about that, this whole point about, you know, how he's been called the godfather of rhythm and blues, but he didn't care too much for that. But he settled in Watts, and it became a very important place in his life, you know?
Yeah.
Which was, and I, to me, you know, it's sort of like, and it's, it was interesting just reading the, what, you know, the stuff I found to read, this, you know, the stuff that actually you dig around a little bit more. And you see the kind of the deep, you know, basically the deep, deep honesty in terms of who he was and who he wasn't. And yeah. Where that put him,
yeah.
You know?
And he would not hold back on that at all. Along the lines of what Mobolaji is saying, this film is going to be a joyous celebration of someone, you know, who is inspiring on many different levels. When you see his artwork, I'm by the way, the clip that we played in the longer teaser we has a lot of his artwork, which is just absolutely gorgeous paintings of the Black community, of a lot of focus on Black musicians, on the growth of rhythm and blues music, and all of that. It's just, it's really, really remarkable and very inspiring. And because he took the stand that he took, it had a big impact. I mean, he could have had a much bigger musical career. That's part of the story. He could have been a much bigger force in the world of music, but he, for him, the issue was taking a stand and speaking, you know, the reality of life for the Black community, and in particular in the '60s, that became very much part of being part of the struggle. And can we play the next clip, which is what Johnny wrote. After talking about the Black community, then there was the rebellion that happened. And I think what he wrote about the rebellion is very revealing in terms of not just him, but just the reality of what was happening. So that's it.
6 days of rioting in a Negro section of Los Angeles left behind scenes reminiscent of war-torn cities.
There was no pre-planning, no preparatory meetings conducted with parliamentary decorum, no executive board decisions, no pious prayer to kick it off, just bam, and away we go. This one was different. This one came from the victims in person. This one was where it was really at. No picket captains, in fact, no pickets. What the hell for? No singing of "We Shall Overcome." This was way beyond that. This was indeed something else. This is a social revolution. The old ground rules no longer apply. Black people have developed a common will of purpose. In short, the common will of the people says that the time has come for an end to the American color caste system. And the hell with the consequences. I can't read the American white establishment's mind, therefore I don't know if they really see the handwriting on the wall. But I do know that if the Black man is not cut completely free of his misery, he will continue to rock the boat and rock the boat and rock the boat. And I don't mean nonviolent organized demonstrations led by pompous, sanctimonious preachers and self-declared leaders.
One, two, three, four.
Now, it's hard to have you cut that song right there.
Sorry, yeah. By the way, all of the music in this piece is all by Johnny. The film is going to be full of Johnny's music. And one of the things that's going to happen in this film, and this is part of bringing Johnny to the present and bringing not only his stand against white supremacy, but his role in the music world to the present, is we're going to be having current artists do covers of his songs, some of which are very well known. Every Beat of My Heart, which was Gladys Knight and the Pips hit.
I still sing that alone at night.
That's because you want to make sure it's still beating. but that's going to be running through the film as well. And to reiterate something that Mobilaji has brought up, as we can talk about this forever, it's very difficult to fund a documentary film. And it's becoming, even though documentary films are becoming more and more popular and more something that you're seeing on streaming services and in theaters even, the funding world has become much more difficult. It's more international. There's great things happening, but it makes the ground difficult. So one of the key ways that a film like this can get made is through the support of the audience. And even though we only at this point we have a sample, we can send you a link to that sample. I think it'll give you a really good sense of what the film's going to be. And you can show it to your friends. You can watch it yourself. And you can join in our effort to get the film made. We will have a GoFundMe campaign going for the film to bring in as much support as possible. And I would urge you to, if you're interested at all, just throw us an email real quickly at johnnyotisfilm@gmail.com. We're just getting some of this off the ground now, but we will get back to you. We'll send you the link to the sample, and you can become part of what's going to be really a tremendous, a very fun and very compelling and prescient film. I mean, what Johnny was talking about in 1965 is exactly the situation today, and it's and he speaks to, you know, he speaks to something very deep and very profound that has yet to be dealt with.
You know, I think it's really important, and I do think, and we have a little bit of time left, but I want to actually say something around this too, because as we're talking, and I would like you guys to come back very soon and really talk about this in a way that, you know, sort of gets it fleshed out a little bit more, because it's, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, even the stuff you just said, people need to know that when you're talking about that and what existed in this country at that time, you know, if you were black, you could be dead just like opening your eyes up when you woke up at night. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't matter. And when you see somebody like when you see somebody like Johnny Otis getting up and doing this, you know, and it's not, and he wasn't doing it like for sort of a way to sort of like show how cool he was. It was something that he really believed, and he really wanted people to know that this is where he stood, and they should be standing there in the same way. And today, that's even more of a point that people have to dig into, and people have to know there is a lot of truth to which side are you on, and damn it, it matters. It matters which side you're on, you know, and that's a very heavy thing. When you look at this, when you look at that, and especially when Johnny Otis is the person who came from where he came from, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, come on now, you can't, you described him on the way in, you know, he wasn't like a gangster dude, he wasn't a dude who just had all this other stuff, but he was somebody who loved the people, and he refused to stand against people who were being just killed.
Brutalized.
Yeah.
Yep, and in addition to that, I would say what's also beautiful about this film is that as a team, our team reflects the world that Johnny imagined and that Johnny created himself, right? So we have a mixed team of, you know, of people of different ethnicities, you know, David Zeiger, you know, of European ancestry, me of African ancestry, our cinematographer of African ancestry, our editor of European Answer. There's a very mixed team that's committed to the same thing, the same values that Johnny was committed to. So, and we're also a team that's actually, you know, got experience making films. And, you know, David's got several films under his belt. I've got one film under my belt that's doing really well. So we're really approaching this in a way that also is very reflective of the values and the commitments that Johnny Otis had. So beyond just the external or the film itself, the community and the team behind it is very much reflective of the politics and the attitude that Johnny had as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very important, and especially in today's world, you know, it's very important.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually, and we're looking at this now, and I have to say, I hate this to hang up on all this because there's so much more to talk about, you know, and so maybe we can have you guys come back again real soon and talk about it some more.
Okay.
I think it'd be really good.
Absolutely. We can talk a lot, can't we, Mom?
Yeah. Yes. And I mean, I'm going to say it one last time, though. The folks, if you're interested in the history of Johnny Otis and you want to see the full teaser, for the film, email us at johnnyotisfilm@gmail.com. We thank you, Michael, for having us on the show, for really speaking to this, you know, music revolutionary Johnny Otis, this artist, for allowing us the opportunity to speak about his life and to begin to do the work to really honor his legacy, and by doing so sort of create a new future for all of us to live into, where we can work in solidarity with one another and we can stand up for freedom and for justice, and we can continue to do that. I know that's always been your commitment, Michael, and I acknowledge you for that long history and that work, as I've always known you to do. And we want to continue in that tradition again. So just email us at johnnyotisfilm@gmail.com. Get the teaser, get more information. And, you know, help support this wonderful project that I think will make a difference in all of our lives and will be a joy to just watch.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know it made a tremendous difference in my life just reading through the stuff, preparing for this. Dave, you were going to say something?
Nope.
Talk to you again next week.
In every beat of my heart, there's a beat for you. In every toast of wine, there's a toast for you. Though we so